Welcome back to Preacher Handshake. I'm Evan.
And I'm Hannah, and we're your hosts. This episode, we talk with Reverend Sean R. James and look at a sermon he preached at Salt and Light in Philadelphia on March 9th, 2025. The sermon is called Trust in God and is based on Job 13:15.
Reverend Sean James is the senior pastor of Salt and Light, an interdenominational and intergenerational congregation in Southwest Philadelphia and Mount Airy. He has a BS in biology from Florida Agricultural and Mechanical University, an MDiv from Lutheran Theological Seminary of Philadelphia, and he's done doctoral work at Lancaster Theological Seminary. Reverend James is the Associate Conference Minister of Congregational Development for the Pennsylvania Southeast Conference of the UCC.
In 2023, he helped develop King Sessing Heal's Community Resiliency Center, which is a federally funded trauma-informed resource center that helps local residents cope and thrive in the face of gun violence. In 2025, Reverend James received the President's Volunteer Service Award for dedication to community service from President Joe Biden. He is married to Kesha, and they share three sons, Clarence Milton, Jesse Joseph, and Sean Benjamin.
I love getting to talk with Reverend James. He is such an engaging speaker, and I just love the way that he revealed both his preparation and the fresh insights that he was able to bring to the book of Job and to texts and passages that maybe we're familiar with, but he turned it in ways that I had never thought about before that was really inspiring. And he was able to reveal how that works within his tradition and within his thinking and all of these things that are going on in the background that helped inform this sermon. And I can't wait for everybody to hear it.
Yeah, I love that he takes some time to really unpack some of the bad theology we have, especially when it comes to Job and his story. He talks a lot about our relationship to like trials and tribulation and the way that we understand that, and really kind of brings such a fresh insight to the story of Job, especially as we're thinking about like challenges that maybe come with interpreting this well and using this well. So it was just a really powerful conversation, and I'm excited for people to hear it. As always, you can listen to Sean's full sermon through the link in our show notes.
Enjoy this conversation with Reverend Sean James. Well, thank you, Reverend Sean James, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It's a blessing to be here.
We are so excited that you're here. To get started, we want to know, what is your relationship to preaching?
So my relationship to preaching is a love affair built on absolute respect. I respect preaching. I am in love with preaching. I think that everything that the Bible tells us about preaching is true. But for me personally, individually, I believe that preaching is a wonderful gift that we've been given by God, both as a gift for those who do the proclaiming and as a gift for those who hear the proclaiming. And for me, I value both of them equally. I value the times when I am the preacher. I absolutely value the times. Currently, we're in a Lenten series where our associates are preaching, and sitting there and listening to great preaching is just as valuable to me as preaching. So, this is a love affair for me that began as the son of a preacher. My father was a preacher, and I think an extremely good preacher. And most of who I am in preaching and the way that I preach was planted in me by my father. My father was a narrative preacher, and he preached, which was also very unique at his time. My dad preached using everyday lessons, words, songs to relate the word of God. My dad's goal was, he said, you know you're preaching well if you can look at the children and they're paying attention to you and they know what you're saying. So my dad's model for preaching, believe it or not, was Jesus, and likewise for me. I think the way Jesus preached, and I think I wish I could get more people to accept this, that Jesus' preaching style is the preaching style. You take simple, everyday things that are right in front of people. You take the most basic things that people already know about and use them to explain the more complex things. And so through my father, I developed this, really strong love affair for How can you take the absolute most complex spiritual concept and make it so simple that a child sitting in the congregation is actually picking up on what you're talking about? So I love preaching and I love the work of it.
Oh, thank you. I think that's so helpful. And, I've just been thinking about that in my own preaching recently, as we've got kind of a growing youth ministry and kids ministry, and a history of kids and youth not being super engaged in the second half of the service. It's kind of a traditional way of, and the question was, well, what do we do to help, can we create something for them, whatever? And thought, well, why don't we rethink how we're doing church if they don't, if it's not engaging? So I love that model, that and it comes through in the preacher that we're going to listen to today. I want to hear, if you don't mind, share a little bit about your congregation and your context for this sermon. Who are you preaching to? Who are these folks? Tell us about your church.
Sure. So about 20 years ago, I literally sat at the table I'm sitting at right now, my dining room table, and put a map of the city of Philadelphia on my table. There were about 10 people that were with me. We had all previously been a part of a very well-established, politically connected, what we in the black church called white stocking, white glove, high steeple church that we'd all previously been a part of. We decided we want to do something different. Took a map of the city, put it on my dining room table. And someone who was with us that day said, Sean, Southwest Philadelphia is the sickest, poorest, and least educated section of Philadelphia. And if you want to do effective ministry in Philadelphia, you need to go there. Now, at that time, what I didn't know was when you plant a church, you're supposed to do a demographic study, and you're supposed to make sure that there is a certain income level, a certain education level, a certain number of two-family households, all these things you're supposed to do before you plant a church. I didn't know that. All I know is I heard this young lady and the Lord say, "Get thee to Southwest Philadelphia," very similar to Jonah's call to go to
Yeah,
Nineveh.
right.
No one would have ever planted a church in Southwest Philadelphia, trust me. But that's what the Lord told me to do, and that's where we went. So we now have locations in Mount Airy and Southwest Philadelphia, which can't be two different sections of Philadelphia. Our 8 o'clock service is in Mount Airy, probably the highest income African American community in Philadelphia. So this is where your more kind of well-to-do African Americans live in Philadelphia. Southwest Philadelphia is an area of low income and poverty, particularly because it is a high immigrant and a high Section 8 population. And I'm setting this all up to kind of explain that I actually end up preaching. We have three services now, and I really end up preaching to kind of three separate crowds. The 8 o'clock crowd is a little older, a little more well-to-do, more professional in their development and in their career. And then we do, and that service is in Mount Airy. So we do 8 o'clock in Mount Airy, and then we do 9:30 and 11:30. And the clip we're going to hear specifically from the 11:30 service in Southwest Philadelphia. The 9:30 service is the hardcore Jesus people service. I mean, those are the people who come. They come to have church. The 11:30 service, believe it or not, is actually the we. At 9:30 is too early for us to get up. So this is our younger service, our younger service, which, if I'm honest with you, is one of the harder preaching services. But each service has its own unique personality. And I preach the same sermon at all three services. Every now and then I won't, but for the most part, I preach, especially if I'm doing a series, I preach the same sermon at all three services. So I'd say 95% of our church is African American. After the pandemic, an interesting change in our church has been the number of churched people that we have. Before the pandemic, like most planted churches, we mostly attracted people who were new to the faith. So we mostly attracted seekers and people who'd never been baptized. It was always amazing to me to meet 40, 50, 60-year-olds who never committed themselves to the Lord, which is a northern phenomenon more than a southern one. Like I'm originally, a lot of time in Atlanta, and everybody I know in Atlanta goes to church. Very different up north, and it's particularly in Philadelphia. So most of our church then was seekers. Now, after the pandemic, we started to attract, mostly because of our online presence early on and things like that, we started to attract church people. So now we're preaching to, like previously I would have said, I preach mostly to an unchurched crowd. Now I preach to a mix, very much a mix. A lot of people who know the Lord for a long time, a lot of people who don't. A lot of people who've been in church for a long time, a lot of people who are very new. So even in the story that I told Sunday, while I think it's a story that church people know off the top of their head, I always have to remind myself that there are a lot of people in our congregation who are unchurched. So 95% African American, multitude of economic and educational places in our church. So we got PhDs and we got no D's and we got GEDs and everything that's there. And honestly, one of the wonderful things about the personality of our church is all of that is all around the church, and you never really would be able to tell that. That, of course, there's been some really purposeful work because even in the African American churches, and maybe even more in the African American churches, our churches sometimes tend to populate based on economic status and kind of the job you do, and that also kind of then influences the worship style. But for us, we've been really purposeful in creating a worship style that makes everyone feel comfortable, but also creating an atmosphere that is very egalitarian as far as who people are and where they come from. I think for me, we're trying to look more like the kingdom. Another interesting point is that the few Caucasian folk that we do have in our church, we do have several, actually go back to a time when a long time ago, the building that we're in was a Presbyterian church, a white Presbyterian church in that neighborhood. And we've had some folks that have held on. I mean, it's a lot of spooky stuff that I could talk about as far as prayer is concerned and like how so many churches during white flight end up having to close or become apartments or things like that. But crazy enough, for all of these years, and we're talking about 100, 175 years now, this church building has maintained ministry from a 100% white Presbyterian church to now a close to 100% black neo-Pentecostal type church. And so there are a few of that population that have held on. And honestly, they love the church. They mostly love the fact that it's vibrant again. You know, there was a fall between Presbyterian church kind of coming black Presbyterian church kind of falling down to about 20 or so people, and then our coming in and kind of taking over and everything getting going again. Another thing I think is really important to say about our church preaching wise is these are people who actually really do value preaching. And we have great music, we have great ministries, we have a fantastic youth ministry, and I believe in holistic ministry. But you don't come to Salt and Light unless you value preaching. Because we put such a high value in preaching, and there's, I believe, the way in which we present the Word of God lets people know most people come to our church because of the preaching. And so these are people who come every Sunday. Like I'm looking in their faces, and they're sitting there with this big question mark on their forehead, and they're like, "Sir, what do you have to say? We want to see Jesus now. Come on, what you got?"
Oh, thank you for sharing that. And it's so resonant. Hannah and I were, say we were on a teaching team together at a church in Texas, and we had four services and two different spaces and different style. And we would often use that similar language of it's basically four different congregations, and they all have different backgrounds and expectations, and it impacts that preaching event
Absolutely
as
does.
you're navigating the different personalities of the what is one church, but really is expressed four different
I think
ways.
what's really interesting about that, and I try to when I'm teaching preaching or like even giving advice to our preachers, is to know that in a situation like this, like any given Sunday, I might find any of the three where what I would consider the best, which is like really weird. Like there's sometimes I'm like the 8 o'clock crowd tells me I practice on them, but there are sometimes where the 8 o'clock is actually the best sermon. Now the 8 o'clock people watch the 9:30 and the 11:30, but sometimes 8 o'clock is I feel like I did my best. Sometimes 9:30 pulls out a great sermon. Sometimes 11:30 pulls out a great sermon. So it's weird how those different personalities also, depending on what I'm saying and how I'm preaching it, pull out different things.
Oh, it's so true. Yeah, we would at the end be after the Sunday morning be like, okay, now for the YouTube version, send the 9:30 or like because you would know which one you felt
That's good.
that you connected with. Yeah.
That's so true. And I love that you have done the work, obviously, to be able to read your people really well. I imagine that that probably spends a lot of your time as you're thinking about preparing, of like thinking through the ways that you're going to speak to each particular crowd and what each venue looks like and all those sorts of things. Can you speak more to what, in addition to that kind of work you're doing, what your sermon prep process looks like throughout the week?
Sure, absolutely. So sermon prep to me is like critically important. And this is one of the ways I try to explain it. The most important preaching class I ever had in my life was my 9th and 10th grade English class. I had a fantastic teacher in 9th and 10th grade English. In fact, in 9th grade, we wrote our first 10-page research paper. So we wrote a full 10-page graduate school research paper. We had like 100 works cited, bibliography, everything. And our instructor was really careful about making sure we developed the skills of how to make an argument, how to create a thesis, how to then explain that thesis, how to make your point, and how to come to a conclusion. And I'm telling you, like, really, real talk, that is the best teaching class I've had, because still to this day, that's my process. I began with what I want people to get. What is my main point? What is the main thrust of the sermon? I then go through the process of, now, here's what I need to say to get people to this point, right? So I began with that. And then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I consider free thought days. And what I do is everything that I get, I just write it down. I don't begin to organize it. I'm listening to the Lord. I'm in the shower. I'm driving my car. And literally, I like nowadays being able to voice record things, because what you do is back in the day, you say, oh man, that was a great thing that just came to me while I was playing basketball. I need to write that down. And then after you finish playing basketball, you have no idea what that thing was, and it's completely gone. And so what I've learned now is that I just voice record it. So free thought, first 3 days, I'm getting everything. It's coming in. I'm thankful, hopefully. Now, sometimes I get to Wednesday, I have nothing. But in a good week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, things are coming. I'm listening, and I'm just writing it down, writing it down. Around Thursday, then I start to organize it. And I say, based on my thesis, based on the point that I'm trying to make, based on the main thing I want people to get, here's how I have to get to that based on the text. So using the text and using the scripture, I first need to say this. I then need to say this. I then need to say this. I then need to say that. And that'll get me to my conclusion. Not always 3 points. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's two. Sometimes it's one. Sometimes it's five. But whatever I need to do to eventually get to that place, that is my goal. And so then sometime around Friday, Saturday is when I start to write out my full manuscript. I believe in having a full manuscript, and I take a full manuscript with me to the pulpit. Now, you may have noticed in the video that I rarely look down at it now. Unless I may be doing a run that I don't remember exactly all the steps of the run. But I believe for the organizational reasons, especially in a full manuscript. And I do think that that is one of the deficiencies that I often hear in preaching nowadays, is the organization that could have been helped if everything had been done. So with the preachers that I teach, and with the preachers at our church as well, even though some of them are not, and I understand this and I see this in them, there are a lot of my preachers that are not manuscript type preachers. I encourage them to write the whole thing out anyway, even if you don't take it up there with you. And especially for this reason, there's certain lines in the sermon that are absolutely critical. The lines themselves are not critical, but how you get to the line is the most important part. And so, in order to get to that line, I need you to make sure you move through the right steps, right? Here's another reason to go with the full manuscript, and this will be similar, is a mistake I hear a lot of preachers make also, is they're so eager to get to the good part that they give it all away at the beginning. And I can even tell with some of them, they weren't intending to do that. Like you weren't even intending to give the good part away at the beginning, but you just got so happy and excited. And so get, write it all out, be patient with it, know what steps you need to get to so that you can eventually get to the end. So, there are 800,000 different ways of looking at preaching. And a lot of people, privately, we were talking a little bit about Joe Gregory. And Joe Gregory's concept is that you should give the end from the beginning and then kind of work your way back there. That's not mine. I like to leave the tension. I know where I'm going. I like to present the antithesis first. I present the problem first. I'm a little bit of that kind of problem in the text, problem in society type preacher. I really set up the problem first, and then I start to work my way towards where the solution is in the text.
I took Joe Gregory for preaching one and struggled with that model a little bit. But who was I to question? And it works. And when I get in trouble, I still go back to it because it always works. But I found that creating that narrative tension, especially in our current context and with unchurched folks and people with a lot of questions, like to be able to create that tension draws them in a way that having that big idea up front, though, is helpful.
you lose some of the power, I think, as you
I
build your way.
completely agree with
Yeah,
that. Yeah, I completely
it's
agree.
good stuff.
I think for the unchurched as well, or just, and I would definitely say for a younger crowd, which my church tends towards, connecting the sermon to their current lived experience, which unfortunately the most part is going to be what they're struggling with, is extremely helpful. And so I like to get to the struggle, and I like for them to be able to see the struggle and then work our way towards the struggle to the solution.
So I wanted to ask this as we, or before we start to look at actual clips of this specific message. One of the things that struck me about your preaching is the sync that you are in with your musicians, your music director. I mean, there is punctuation and just constant kind of involvement to kind of illustrate, illuminate as you're proclaiming. And I was curious about your relationship with your music leaders, and if there's you've talked a lot about your preparation. It's clear that there's so much work going in there. Is there preparation in that connection and where you're going? Did they get the manuscript ahead of time? Tell us a little bit about that, if you don't mind.
Very interesting. Yeah, no, great question. Great question. So, the organic nature of that is something that African American preachers and churches do that for a long time we had no idea where it came from. It's only recently that it's been discovered that this is actually an African practice that goes back to a time that we didn't really understand. And in West Africa, the personality that was usually kind of like the diviner was called the griot. And usually when that person started to do their work, what we discovered is that usually there would be beating music, the drum, you know how important the drum was in African societies, that would go along with it. And so the rhythm that is a part of African American preaching and the melody, is something that really is kind of African in its nature that we've kind of brought into America. Again, most of us have no idea and did not know that. And some really good research has gone recently into kind of bringing an understanding of that. So there's a part of it that is just germane and natural to who we are. For me specifically, I like that type of push all throughout the sermon. In a lot of areas of African American preaching, they will wait till the celebration. And only in the close will they bring that in. You probably noticed that with my musicians, we do it early on, all throughout the sermon. And because I think that the sermon ain't, the ending ain't, is not just the good part. It's not just the part and there's sometimes very early on where the emphasis of it, and really it kind of emphasizes what's going on. We don't practice it. We don't talk about it. They don't know. They just know what I expect. It's interesting. What we've also learned is that I'm unique in that, and that most other preachers, guest preachers, or even some of the other preachers from their church, don't want that. They don't want it until they get to the very end. And so they usually don't even consider coming in. But with me, they know I'm absolutely fine with it throughout the sermon. Now, what is important about communication with the sermon now for us is the tech team. I did not in this sermon, but I am leaning more into the use of technology and screens and videos and video clips, even pictures and stuff during the sermon. We have this huge screen behind my head when I'm preaching. You can't see it in the clip because it's above, but I am really into now, and I've got some really great examples. There's just wonderful times when I've kind of leaned it. I did a sermon on scars and the ministry of your scars, and I used an African American actor recently died, but he has a huge scar that ran from the top of his forehead all the way down. And just his picture on the screen for the majority of the service, and while I was, trying to explain, and he, early on in his career, people suggested to him that he get plastic surgery, that he get it covered up, but it actually became his trademark. And a lot of the parts that he got was because he had this scar running down. So this is a gentleman that played Omar in The Wire. It was because of that scar that he actually got his work. And so I've learned, and what I'll do is I will give the full manuscript to the tech team. And I'll say, at this point, pull up this video. At this point, pull up this picture. At this point. And so I do go through the whole thing with them. And that's one of the things I'm trying to teach more. Because what I will tell you is for young people, it's crazy. Not just trying to teach more. I spend a whole lot of time now trying to convince churches to put screens in and try to convince them that, like, if you want to have young people, this is a screen generation. You can harp on books all you want to. They don't even really get textbooks anymore. Even most of their schooling is done on a screen. And so teaching and preaching for me, that the lean in I'm making now is leaning to this idea of using technologies and screens and video clips and pictures during the sermon. And then I will communicate that with the tech team. With the band, it's really just a feel. We will every now and then talk about the song that we close with. Now, from a Black preaching perspective, and I don't know if you're familiar with this term, but you'll know I am not a hooper, and that's a term that's used for kind of like this kind of singing rhythmic closing. I don't do that, and it's a gift that I don't have. I close mostly and particularly either with a story or with a song. And usually, either with that story, that song, the band already knows where I'm going. So they will either pick the song up and keep going with it, or we'll talk about, well, what's a good song that both connects with the sermon and creates a good invitation situation. So we want to end with a song that has a connection to the end of the sermon and the invitation moment.
Yeah, I'm really impressed with and thinking about in the creation of in the preaching process to how collaborative it is to be able to and what role the musicians and your tech team gets to have in this act of proclamation, that they're not just punctuating but participating in it, and that's
Absolutely,
such a value.
absolutely. Which speaks to just the idea of Black preaching in general. Now, let me say this. I've got this theory, y'all hang in with me on this. I think that if Black church and white church ever get together and talk, we actually could make something fantastic and bring together the different nuances of that we do good. And these are generalizations, of course, but I think there are certain things that Black church and white church just kind of naturally do well culturally, right? And what I've tried to do at Salt and Light is, so we're technically denominationally UCC and Presbyterian. So I'd spent a lot of time in kind of white church spaces. And I knew the
Yeah.
things that white church do well, and organizing and planning and meeting. I mean, we say that the UCC, they meet about the meeting. Like before there's a meeting about what's going to happen at the meeting. And then they actually have the meeting. And so like I've tried to bring into, and so in Black church, generalization again is kind of free and spirit led. And we just leaving it out there for the Holy Spirit to do whatever the Holy Spirit wants. Well, what if we could do both? What if it was spirit and truth? And so I've been trying to create this church atmosphere where we plan and we organize. We got some great, there's such great software right now around church planning and worship planning that we try to do all of that planning, but then leave room for the work of the Spirit. It actually happened yesterday at the 11:30 service, where the Spirit moved so thick in the middle of service that it was such a good move that I couldn't go from there into the announcements. Like the next thing on the order of service was the announcements. And I was just like, okay, we went from there straight to the sermon, which I was not preaching. We had guests yesterday. We not guests. We had To honor Women's History Month, three of our sister preachers preached yesterday. And at the 11:30 service, went straight from this, the kind of like the middle selection slot. Normally, after that would be announcements, welcome of visitors, all that kind of stuff before we got to the meditation selection and then the sermon. I'm like, nope, we're going straight to the sermon, which there's a freedom in that. But even to me, the more organized you are, the easier it is to decide at the right time that you actually want to make a shift into something different.
Well, let's look specifically at the one of the ways that you begin this message. You give this really powerful section thinking about trusting God, and I'd like to listen to a clip of that.
Can you still trust God when you can't trace God? Can you still trust God when there's no evidence that God is still on your side? Can you still trust God when it feels like God has completely forgotten your name? Can you still trust God when you've been pressing your way through an unanswered prayer? Can you still trust God when everybody has walked out on you and nobody is looking out for you? Can you still trust God when you can't make a way out of no way because there ain't a way to be made because you can't find it? Can you trust them even when you're going through?
And what a powerful way to begin. These are powerful examples you give of ways that people may struggle to trust God. And knowing what you've told us about how in tune you are with your congregation, I'm wondering how you decided what were those things that you were going to include in this list of maybe reasons why people struggle to trust with to trust God.
Sure. So this is the second sermon of a series, and The first sermon was from Proverbs 3, trust the Lord with all thy heart and lean not to thy own understanding. So I'd already done a sermon on just the unique, wonderful nature of trusting God, why it's necessary, beautiful stuff, full heart, lean out on your own understanding, right? And so this next sermon was going a little deeper. So yes, you can trust God when the sun is shining. Yes, you can trust God because he's blessing. Yes, you, but let's really talk about what trust is. So here's what I can tell you about my church that I really value is they really enjoy living in these tough spots. My church does not expect cotton candy sermons. They don't expect me to come in there and just tell them that everything's going to be great. They don't expect self-help sermons. They don't expect me to come in and just tell them, read the scripture and you're going to live on sunshine and rainbows. They are expecting me to help them work through the tension and the difficult points of life. And so this was a list that really come that kind of comes out of and breathes out of a general way of explaining the difficulties that maybe everyone is having. Now you'll notice I wasn't too specific here. Like I didn't go into things like divorce or hardcore financial problems because I wanted to do generalizations that everyone would hear something in each one that related to their situations. There will be times when I will get a little bit more specific, but I really try to make sure that I am shooting more with a shotgun and not a rifle, if you understand what I'm saying. I want to hit everybody. I want everyone to get and to find something in what I'm trying to say. Usually when I do runs, that's exactly what I'm thinking. And in Black church, we kind of call that a run. Like you start to run through a list of things. And usually when I do that, I'm like, okay, I want to make sure everybody here's what I'm saying. And there's sometimes I will pull a thing out. Like there may be something that in my kind of like in my free thought time, I need to say this, I need to say that. And then once I start to kind of get more specific, I'm like, no, I don't want to say this because this only kind of applies to a specific group. Now, not that there aren't times when I would do some type of work like that, but in a situation like that, I wanted during that time to say something where no one sitting in there could think to themselves, I haven't experienced the difficulty of trust that he's talking about. So I wanted to give a list that was comprehensive. That's the way to say it, and make sure that everyone kind of felt what I was saying.
Yeah, I imagine there are so many things that you gave that were, you're right, very general. But then I love you see throughout the sermon, you do get really specific at times too. So I see you kind of playing with that general, broad, everybody kind of catches everybody in that. And then the let's be maybe a little more specific that is maybe speaking to particular things in your setting. So you do something early on, which I think is so important, where you talk about some of the bad theology that has been attached, especially to Job. You say at one point that everything we believe about trials and tribulations is tied up in this text. And then you talk about maybe some of the bad interpretations that we have about Job. And I'm just so curious about how you kind of came to this conclusion where Job really does inhabit a lot of these bad theological readings you've come to realize. And why do you think that preaching is a tool for combating bad theology?
Very good. That's a great question. So for this one in particular, what's really weird about it is an internally bad theology, one that literally goes back to the beginning of time. It's hard to find it. And that's the weird thing about how bad theologies work, is even though there is much evidence in the Bible, including specific times when Jesus preaches against this, we still struggle with this very thought. And this is the thought that if something bad is happening in your life, you have to have done something bad to cause it, right? And I use the example in the sermon of Jesus and disciples, and they meet this man. And like literally, there are certain occasions that happen in Jesus' life or even all throughout the Bible where there's an extremely specific thing that it's trying to handle. So I would almost say that the whole reason why Jesus and his disciples happened upon this man is because Jesus wants to handle this really bad thing that people have been believing for a very long time. So disciples see this man, been blind since birth, and disciples are living under this notion that if something bad happens to you, I mean, and I would say in Jesus' time, maybe even more, like they really were like, okay, this was their entire theological concept. You're suffering, you did something bad. Well, he was born blind. So how do you explain that? Well, they were so stuck on this idea that their explanation was, well, his parents must have done something wrong, and he's suffering because of what they've done. Of course, Jesus does his best to not say to them, no, he's not suffering because he did something wrong or suffering because his parents did something wrong. But in this case, Jesus said he's suffering so that the glory of God might be revealed through him. And so I wanted to deal with it. I think Job deals with, I think there's a lot in Job. I mean, Job is just so thick, but Job really deals with this idea that our suffering has to be connected to sin. Has to be connected to something you've done wrong. And sin being, of course, the main one. Like, this is the hard part. And I still, still to this day, people come to me. And I can't even say that I'm devoid of this problem myself. I sometimes am dealing with some stuff. And I'm thinking, man, what did I do that caused, why would God put me through this? And a number of times that church people come to me. But then I still hear sermons. I still know people. And especially out of some of the more apostolic Pentecostal holiness worlds where this really is their thought. Like, you are either blessed and highly favored because you're doing right, or you're suffering because you're doing wrong. Well, explain Job. Explain a man that Jesus, that God, I'm sorry, describes as upright and righteous and doing everything he could to live right. And then he suffers in probably the most unimaginable way that any of us could. And so I really think it's important, as often as possible to, and I'll say this too. I didn't say this specifically in this sermon, but I do say it a lot of times. I am fighting against the televangelist. Not that all televangelists is bad, and not that all that they say is bad. And I will tell you, I during COVID, thank God for the televangelists, because they taught us how to look into the camera and how to talk while, to a congregation while we're also talking to an online or television crew. But so much of what we have to combat nowadays are people who are coming to church having developed most of their theological understanding on, and nowadays more even so, on social media and from 30-second clips of sermons, where a lot of times they're just going to get some really, really bad stuff that are that is not a part of Christian theology. And so that conversation that Jesus has with the disciples and the book of Job ought, to me, ought to be enough for people to know. Sometimes you're, sometimes your suffering is the ramifications of your actions, no doubt about it. There are sometimes when, and let me also connect this. This is a wonderful piece of this that I think comes out of African American theological thought. Sometimes it's what we call unmerited suffering. Sometimes your suffering is completely unmerited, but we believe that that type of suffering is redemptive. Unmerited suffering is redemptive. You are going to suffer for absolutely no reason sometimes. Now, there's a whole wonderful theology about how God operates in that, and how you have to trust God and what's actually happening, and all that good stuff. But just to know, especially to a person who is still developing their understanding of God, to know, yes, there are going to be some times when you were going to go through something. And I think the language I use is not because you've done something wrong. It could actually be because you've done something right. And you need to know how you and God are going to work your way through that and understand it, right? I've had both in my life. I've had plenty of sufferings where I knew, I'd say, I know exactly why this is happening. And usually it's the ramification of something. I've also gone through some things and, grown spiritually to a point where nowadays I can sometimes look at some stuff and say, all right, God, what are you trying to teach me? What are you trying to grow in me? What are you trying to show me? What am I supposed to learn from this season?
Preaching through Job right now as well, and it's been so helpful for me, and I hope my congregation, I think so, and when I've preached it before with students or whatever. I mean, there's really this that retributive theology, right? If God's gonna zap you if you're bad and give you money if you're good, right, or whatever it is so prevalent, and which is everywhere, and so I really love how you pulled that out and made that so clear. At one point, you're playing around with the introduction to Job, which is the kind of throne room scene where the Satan shows up, and you're really playing with that idea. And I did not see this coming. You make this contrast with God being willing to invite the devil into this scene with your own members. And so I want to play that clip.
God is having a meeting of all the sons of heaven, and the devil got invited to the meeting and had the nerve to show up. Now, I'm not gonna sit here, but I want you to think about this week in your own spirit. How is it that God could call a meeting in heaven and sit down with the devil that tried to have a coup up in heaven, the devil that tried to overthrow God from his own position, the devil that took a third of the angels and got thrown out of heaven. God can sit down and meet with them, but you can't come to choir rehearsal and sit next to somebody because then you heard they've been talking about you.
I love that part of the sermon. It made me laugh. And, you know, I'm pastoring in a mostly white mainline context and in a more kind of progressive context. And so when in those contexts, I've noticed most of the time our preaching is often characterized by, you know, hey, the love of God is all through it. But there seems to be maybe an allergy to calling people out.
Okay.
But my preacher friends of color do such a beautiful job of holding both, you are so loved, and also, I just love and admire and would love to get better at that ability. So I'd love if you share a little bit about the role of calling people out in your congregation through the preaching.
So let me say a couple things about that. One is that is some very, very delicate work, which you'll notice here was not the whole sermon, didn't stay there long, because I think you're going to drive your congregation away. And I know some hellfire and brimstone preachers who spend their whole sermon calling people out. Also, what I tell associates, and again, in homiletics classes, I tell people, certain work is unique senior pastor work. And that's a part of it. And I really try to get my associates to get this, because every now and then, one of them will feel like, oh, let me go handle this issue. And this is what I say to them. The more specific the issue, even, the more you need to let me handle it. You don't preach towards things you see going on in the church. Don't preach about situations that we need. And there are, of course, because over time and experience, I've learned how to deal with what's right in front of us. I've learned what to remain general. I've learned what to talk about specifically. I've learned how to shroud it in jokes and laughter. I've learned how to make it subversive. So half the time, people don't know I'm talking about them. But I've also learned that we have to deal with some of these things. I think the worst thing we do sometimes is when we completely leave them out. And for me, the number one thing that I'm going to talk about like that is how we treat each other. Like my number one point where I will find it necessary in sermonic moments will be, it won't necessarily be about your own individual sin. It won't be about, you know, necessarily the things that you're doing. I'll get on societal stuff, no doubt about it. But how we treat one another, especially in church, is one where I have no problem talking about that and making sure that people understand. Because one of the most important priorities and values of our church is welcome, is how we interact with one another, is creating an atmosphere where there is love, joy, peace among each other. And it's rare for me to preach a sermon where I don't have something in there that talks about how we treat one another. And especially when I can, like, again, this was not the main point. In fact, these little kind of, we sometimes in Black preacher call them parenthetical points. So I'm just going to put a parenthesis around this. I also think are also ear perking moments, because even if someone is starting to get a little bored by what I'm talking about, if I'm talking about too consistently, let me throw something in that's a little off subject that might kind of wake you up and get your attention back on the sermon.
Oh, well, it did that. And it was in the shroud and humor and all that. I mean, it's just so effective. At one point you say sometimes, and you mentioned this earlier, we might be facing trials, not because of something we've done wrong, but maybe sometimes because of something we've done right. So I want to share that clip with you.
Some situations you're going to face in this life are not because you've done something wrong. It's because God has been bragging about you. And because God has been bragging about you, that's why you're going through it right now. That God is up in heaven telling the devil, have you noticed her? Have you noticed him?
Why did you want to pull that forward? I mean, you know, I'm preaching Job right now and had not really taken that angle at any point.
Yeah.
And I love it. And I want to hear why you think that's so valuable.
Sure.
To share that.
So let me do something more general before I discuss that. I think that preaching is a gift. I think that we're living in a time in a lot of places, if I'm going to be very honest with you, and this will just show you just my pure unadulterated love for preaching, is I feel like feel like we flooded the market with preachers. I feel like there's a thing that preachers have, and I want to explain it this way. Every now and then, you ought to hear something from the Lord that puts a chill in your body. And you think to yourself, man, I've been a Christian a long time. Okay, so I'm going to tell you my first one. I was in college. I accepted my call to ministry when I was 20. I think it was my third sermon. I preached from the woman who had been accused of adultery, right? All the years I've been hearing this story, and I think that these are new things. So, and also because I think sometimes preachers get so caught up on trying to say something nobody said before that you say some foolishness. But I look at this story, and like, one of the principles of the story is the Pharisees and Sadducees, the scribes, trying to catch Jesus breaking the law. That's actually what they were trying to do. They had nothing to do with this woman. They were trying to catch Jesus breaking the law. Jesus says to them, listen, I'm not going to break the law, because they said the law of Moses says we have to stone her. What do you say? Knowing that out of compassion, Jesus is not going to let them stone this woman. They know him. So he says, so, okay, now I'm not going to tell you not to stone her. I would be breaking the law if I did that. But let's agree to this. Let's have the person in this crowd that does not have sin throw the first stone. After that happens, the rest of y'all knock yourself out. But we'll just let's just agree that the first stone ought to be thrown by a sinless person. Interestingly enough, there was someone in the crowd that day that fit that bill. There was a sinless person there. And if he would have thrown the first stone, now I've never heard anybody point that out in all my days of preaching. And when I was 20 years old, the Lord came down and dropped that in my spirit. And that's when I knew for certain. I was like, yeah, I'm supposed to do this. Because I knew that that was a significant part of this text that I'm sure other people have pointed out. And when I hear preaching all the time, what gets me is when I hear the preacher say something that I'm like, flesh and blood did not reveal that to you. Like that Peter moment, right? Flesh and blood didn't. You got that from. So the point that I'm making there is one that I feel similarly about, that one of the points of Job, the flesh and blood certainly did not reveal to me, is sometimes one way you can look at unmerited suffering is maybe similarly, God has been up in heaven. In fact, if you notice, I go much deeper than that as I continue to make this point. Not just that. And then this is the part that I had not seen until this sermon itself, is when the enemy is going to and fro, walking among the earth. It doesn't say this, but we can infer kind of because of other texts and stuff that he's looking to who he's going to mess with. And God said, have you considered Job? So even deeper is this idea. The enemy told God, or God knows, he's looking to mess with somebody. And God says, well, if you're looking to mess with someone, can I make a suggestion? And that sometimes it's actually because you've been doing the right thing that God trusts that you're the person who can endure this situation and come on the other side like pure gold.
So encouraging for the one who feels that unmerited suffering in the moment, you know.
Let me tell you, that Sunday, and you may have heard this in an introduction at the 11:30 service where I mentioned, I won't say his name now, but a pastor in our city who had pastored a very prominent church for a long time and had a different position he has recently lost, been fired from a position. He was there visiting that Sunday, actually with the district attorney, and they had all come to Salt and Light during election season. You know how that is. He came to me afterwards. He was like, you have no idea how much I needed to hear that. I just lost my job, income problems, and I'm trying to figure out what did I do for the Lord to treat me like this. And he said, I really needed to hear that. And I said, brother, I don't know your life, but you literally may not have done anything. It actually may be because of how well you conducted yourself and walked. And that on the other side of this, God is trusting that you actually can handle it. And I said, I just want you to imagine the preaching and the teaching and the writing that you're going to have because you've been through this that you could not have had if you not had that experience.
Yeah, I love that you bring this idea up that, there is a saturation of preaching, and yet sometimes there's still something that maybe it's not a brand new thought, but it's just in the way that it's being said or the way it's being presented that just kind of hits different, honestly, and you think about it. And for me, I had one of those moments listening to this idea of like it's God trusting Job. Trusting that Job's faith can withstand. I listened to that and I like that was a moment for me that I has completely reframed, I think, a lot of the way I think of that story. So I'd love to play the clip and to hear you do that so well.
When God brings Job up to the devil, what he says to him, he says, "Have you considered my servant Job?" The devil says, "I've been going to and fro around the earth." And God says, "Hold on, I want to bring Job up for consideration." Let me say it differently. The devil says, "I've been looking for somebody to mess with." And God says, "Is Job on your list? I want to suggest Job." The devil says, "I've been looking for someone whose life I want to turn upside down." And God says, "I have a suggestion. I want to suggest Job." Because look, if you mess with the wrong person, devil, you're going to mess their whole faith up. If you mess with the wrong person, I'll never see them in church again. If you mess with the wrong person, they'll never say another prayer. If you mess with the wrong person, they'll never sing another song. If you mess with the wrong person, they'll never utter another word to me. But I know Job. Job is my boy, and Job ain't gonna turn his back on me just because you touch him. Consider my servant Job. Which means, watch this. The trust that appears first in the text is not Job trusting God. It's actually God trusting Job.
What just a radical way of reframing this story. I know I can't be the only one who sat there just in shock. Like, I've read this story before, and yet you were able to bring this out. And I also love that it's this kind of reversal of what you said at the first, right? Like, you started your message by saying, "Can you still trust God when you can't trace God?" And then it's this slow flip, this slow reversal of, "Well, can God trust you?" And just this new way of thinking about the story was so powerful. But I also love that you use that kind of reversal, "Can God trust you?" as an understanding for an invitation for people. Traditionally, I think in services we would call this like our altar call moment. All the services building to this moment of maybe it's an invitation to repentance or confession or to join the church or something, and you use this idea of "Can God trust you?" as kind of the thing that puts you into that moment. So I'm curious, how much were you anticipating that moment in the service, and how much do you think, that if that was your intention, like this is where we're ending, how much was that impacting the way that you were developing this sermon?
Sure. So, extremely intentional, for me, probably more than any other part. And this is intentional sermon close, music from the band, and then the praise and worship team coming up and singing the invitational song, is that all of those things have to connect. So to me, and I think last Sunday, I probably leaned this more than any other time. Most important thing, I said this last Sunday, most important thing I'm gonna do all week is give someone an opportunity to give their life to Jesus Christ. Everything I've been doing all week, the sermon preparation in this moment right now, is the most important thing I'm gonna do. So there may be parts of the preaching moment that I leave to a bit of ambiguity. And even in this, there are times when the Holy Spirit comes in and says, "All right, I want to change some things up," but I am very purposeful about my clothes. Now, I will say this. I feel like my weakest natural place is closing the sermon. I think my strongest natural place is the body and then the introduction. So I have to be very careful not to spend so much time on the body that I leave out the introduction. And the introduction, I think, is also very critical. And I have different ways that I kind of introduce a sermon. But the close for me requires the most amount of work. And I always and most importantly, because this is the thing that is going to wrap all of this up and lead someone to saying, you know what, I've decided to make Jesus my choice. And so for this one, absolutely, because in this, hopefully, people are going to hear a trust that now offers you an opportunity to show your trust in God. God trusts you, right? God trusts you with your situations, with what you're going through. He trusts you with his blessings, et cetera, et cetera. And this trust is one that hopefully will lead you to a point of making a decision and being invitational. This is an aspect of Black church that is both positive and negative. The negative part of it is that sometimes people make that choice based on kind of emotional things and how they feel at the time, and because they sit next to grandma and stuff like that. However, the that moment, that sermonic moment, and that ending sermon moment that ends in decision is also like a really wonderful thing, just because it's public decision. We want you to make a public commitment and confession that you are coming to give your life to Christ. When I first started going to predominantly white churches, I was like, when do y'all like when does that happen? And they say, well, you know, I was a Lutheran seminary. So they're like, well, you know, people come to the office, so they call the church. And like y'all don't do any type of like invitation to Christian discipleship or altar call. Like, no, we kind of leave that up. And the public nature of it is an important part for us, what we would consider responding to the gospel. Now, here's another negative part of it, is a lot of times preachers, Black preachers, will judge their preaching based on how many people came down the aisle. And then my words, listen, don't do that. Like the sermon they heard last week, the song they heard yesterday, the voice of God this morning, all of that is tied into a person making that decision. This one sermon, it did not do what was necessary to help someone come to church. And I preached sermons that I thought were horrible, and 15 people came down the aisle. I preached great sermons and nobody, or I felt like it was great and nobody came. So.
So we like to wrap up our conversations with a set of questions that
Okay.
we do for everyone. And the first is what are you most proud of this sermon when you look back at it?
Yeah, so of this sermon, I would say the going deep part, and especially that part about suffering and about God kind of sometimes picking us out. I'm honestly also grateful for the work of the sermon. This sermon took some work. It took some work to kind of get it organized and to say the things that I wanted to say. So I would say I'm proud about those things.
Yeah, anytime that you commit yourself to preaching Job, you're in for like a good arm wrestling with the text. So if you could do anything differently for this sermon, is there anything that you would redo?
So I absolutely hate watching myself preach, mostly because I get excited, and I probably get overly excited at my own preaching, and so sometimes I wish I could calm down, and I wasn't as demonstrative. That demonstrative nature also sometimes leads me into preaching too fast. And so I do sometimes wish that I had a slower cadence, and I've been trying to slow myself down recently. There's a cadence that exists in that, you know, that type of preaching style. But whenever I watch myself, I just think to myself, you need to slow down. And I will sometimes slow down during the sermon, like I'll find and catch myself. But usually, if it starts to feel good to me, then it's hard for me to kind of slow down, quiet down, and just, yeah.
Well, I loved your cadence and speed, and but I do think I find that too for me. Like I don't enjoy watching, and yet those nonverbal or stylistic or present more like in presentation rather than content. That's where I see it when I watch it, and I know my people see it, and then you go, "Oh yeah, those are things I got to work on." So all the time. Well, our final question, and thank you so much for your time and your experience and your wisdom. It's been a blast. I would like to ask why do you think preaching matters today?
Yeah. So God is sovereign. If God wanted to, preaching could happen like this. God could send angels down to every church on Sunday, and an angel could stand up, and an angel would get everything perfect. The preacher would be perfect. The word would be perfect. The theology would be perfect. The diction would be perfect. The examples would be perfect. When you think about that, God is so much God. I think if God wanted to, God could subdivide himself or herself into parts and show up at every. God could do it. But God has decided, in God's infinite wisdom, to put this in us. I want an imperfect vehicle. I want a jar of clay. I want an earthen vessel to be responsible for preaching the gospel. God is brilliant. You can't take mess with God. God knows exactly what God is doing. And the imperfectness of the preacher, to me, is the very thing that makes preaching important and necessary. And I'd say now more than ever, we need people who can stand up in front of people just like themselves, dealing with the very same things they're doing. There's an old spiritual that says that I have a song that the angels cannot sing, right? Because angels ain't been through what I've been through. So why do I not want an angel to come preach to me every Sunday? Angels don't know what I'm going through. But this person does. And so someone who knows my experience, similar experience, been through what I've been through, standing up preaching the gospel is, I think, exactly what is needed in the world, especially today. And I can't see a time when that won't be so, when we won't yearn to hear God's word through earthen vessels.
And well, thank you so much for sharing with us. It was a joy to listen to you preach and to get to talk with you more about it. Thanks
I
so much for
appreciate the
joining us.
invitation, and thank you so much for having me.
We hope you enjoyed our conversation with Reverend Sean R. James. If you'd like to listen to Sean's full sermon or keep up with the work he's doing, you can follow him through the links posted in our show notes. If you liked this episode, please share and subscribe and tell your friends. And if you have questions for us or recommendations for guests we should bring on, you can email us at preacherhandshake@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.